The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette.
Good evening, Aida.
How's it going? I was going to refer to myself as the expert insider and yourself as the legal outcast, but
I might qualify for both, but certainly the outcast part, that's for sure. Hey, so here's a question for you. What do you get for the 100th anniversary? Like, there's paper for five and, you know, nonsense jewelry at 10 or 20. What do you get for 100?
Like, wedding?
Yeah, it's our 100th episode. Our 100th episode.
Oh,
literally the 100th time that we've been on the radio speaking crime and justice. So congratulations.
What have you gotten me, Bruce?
I don't know.
A raise?
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see on the 15th of the month.
We'll see what happens. So we've talked a lot about different things on the show. Talk about our firm sometimes. Tonight, I think we're going to dedicate it to can I say what's wrong with the criminal justice system? Because we're going to discuss a number of problems with the system, starting with the man is going to die tomorrow. Now, of course, in the United States, somebody dies every day. So saying that a man is going to die is not particularly interesting, except that we know who's going to die. And his name is Michael Titus. He's going to die in Missouri. And he will die at the hands of the state of Missouri. He'll be executed.
Just a little background on this man and how the case came to our attention. He was 19 years old in 2000 when he tried to free an imprisoned friend from prison. And he brought a gun to this project, so to speak, along with the imprisoned man's girlfriend. And ultimately, in the commotion, shot at two different guards and killed him. And it appears that there's no question whatsoever that he did this, that he was properly convicted, so to speak. The question is whether or not he deserves to die. And why it's interesting is because, unlike in many other cases, though it's becoming more frequent, many jurors who sentence him to death have come forward and provided affidavits to be attached to his clemency petition, asking the governor to grant the very life that they voted against. Actually, two of them were alternates, but four were seated on the jury. Look, it's been 23 years since the crime and 13 years since those jurors sentenced him. Apparently, there were prosecutorial misconduct issues. So there was a resentencing for which this jury had to sit and decide whether or not they would sentence him to life without parole. So he would ultimately die in prison of old age and not of, you know, an actual execution or death. And a lot of those jurors have come forward and said, we feel bad knowing what we know today.
We would have spared his life.
Right. And some of those reasons include the fact that they realize, and this actually came out during sentencing, this isn't necessarily new information, that Michael Titus at 19 had lived a long life of abuse, neglect. He had documented mental impairments, and he had very good behavior while he was in prison. And what's interesting is that, look, my opinion changes frequently. I'm not too attached to my concepts or my opinions because we learn things about the human condition that we may not have known decades before. Well, and what one of them said was that he learned that The front lobal brain is not fully developed at 19. That's something that's becoming widely known now. And he feels bad because people change. And we've said this before, that someone sitting on death row finally executed 20 some years or 30 some years after the crime was committed is not the same individual who committed the crime.
Right. And look, in some ways, that might just be an argument to speed up the executions, which we obviously can't do because people are entitled to appeals and thorough appellate review of the propriety of the conviction and the propriety of the sentence. There's a photograph in the New York Times of him at the time of the crime, when he was 19 years old. So people should know a couple of things. One, that if an individual commits the same crime, say 14 months earlier, when they were 17 and 11 months, execution is prohibited under federal law. You can't execute minors, and minors is defined as somebody who's under 18. The rationale for that is similar to what you said, is that we recognize that teenagers don't have the same judgment, don't have the capacity for the same judgment as adults do, and thus shouldn't be held to the ultimate penalty for making decisions to commit crimes, even to commit horrific crimes. But they can be held in prison for decades. Mr. Tysis, Michael, but for his execution, would have spent the rest of his life in prison anyway. And there was an explicit appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States asking that they stay the execution so that the defense could present evidence that executing somebody under the age of 21, when their brain has not yet fully developed, is just as unconstitutional, or should be just as unconstitutional, as executing somebody under the age of 17. Just a few hours ago, the Supreme Court denied the stay, dismissed the application for cert or for review. They won't hear the case. And only a few minutes ago, just before we came on the air, the governor has indicated that he is not going to grant clemency and authorize the execution to go forward. By the time you and I come to work tomorrow, Mr. Tysis will be dead at the hands of the Missouri authorities. We talk about the death penalty a lot. Let me give out the phone number. It's 631-451-1039. 631-451-1039. Encourage pro-death penalty people to give us a call, just to liven up the discussion a little bit, because you and I obviously agree on this, and it's always interesting to get somebody else's viewpoint.
The other thing I would just want to mention about this is how many people it actually impacts. Like, the business of capital punishment has an overwhelming effect on individuals you would otherwise not think about, right? So the first person you think about is, okay, the defendant, he fears the death penalty, he fears getting the death penalty. His family members, you know, go through a lot of trauma and pain knowing that he'll be executed or that he's on death row. But there are other players that have a significant role and suffer significant trauma in this. And they include the executioners, as we've come to learn, having spoken on episode 3, we spoke to Ron McAndrew, who was responsible for 4 or 5 botched executions. And he was running a Department of Corrections in Florida. And
right. He wasn't just responsible for botched executions. He oversaw some that were botched, where there were errors, where inmates suffered, where the executions didn't go as planned. But he actually oversaw a number of executions. He was in charge of them.
And he had a come to Jesus moment and ultimately looked at himself in the mirror and said, I can't live with these ghosts. I can't live in this way. I have to stop. He quit his job, and now he's trying to make up for it. So he's become a consultant to defense attorneys nationwide, and he tries to help get released, or tries to help provide mitigating information for people that are facing the death penalty, and also juveniles. And he's not alone. There's a kind of a huge community of former executioners whose lives have been damaged severely by carrying out these executions, whether they were botched or not. The bodies and the ghosts of those bodies weigh heavily on them for the rest of their lives, and they have deep regrets. And also the correction officers that ultimately get close to these individuals day in, day out, you know, giving them food, overseeing them, watching them, chatting sports, football. You get to know people and you know that, okay, maybe they committed a horrific crime, but you get to know a different side of them. And the same is true for the attorneys that represent these individuals for years and get close to them and form a bond. So I feel bad for the six jurors that served on this case. They are haunted now by the experience. They have remorse for their decision. I actually Googled just recently, you know, jurors remorse or regrets on death penalty, and a bunch of articles came up. One in particular in 2016, the individual said, I was 28 years old and I didn't want to vote for death, but I was too weak to stand up to the other 11 individuals. And I kind of went with the crowd because I wasn't a mature 28. I was an immature 28. And I feared speaking up for my views. And it's amazing how that awkwardness, right, can take over and sort of make you freeze and not speak up. And then the decision you have to live with for the rest of your life. I think it's a lot to ask any juror to sentence anyone to death because they're ultimately pulling the trigger, whether they're doing it, you know, physically or not. And they live with that. And I don't think they realize, not all realize, what that's going to feel like 20 years later.
Yeah. Forget the 20 years later, just at the moment it happens. Some of the jurors described going back, on the jury bus. I don't understand why there's a bus, but bringing them back, I suppose, to their vehicles or wherever they were, the hotel, whatever they were staying, and crying and feeling terrible with what they did. I can't imagine what it's like to be in a room on a courthouse, and a courtroom is ultimately just a room and you're only a few feet away from somebody, and go ahead and vote that that person should die, especially if the person is a teenager. The crime happened in 2000. The ultimate sentence that you described was imposed in 2010. But that was 23 years ago when he was 19. So what does that make him now? 42? So he's a relatively young man, has spent 23 years in prison. He's a changed individual. Yet the state of Missouri feels the need to go ahead and execute him. Now, look, I'll talk about the victims some. It's not fair to do this. Two individuals lost their lives that night. They were shot to death by Mr. Tisis. The sister of one of them said the years waiting for this execution have been torturous for her, that it goes on and on and on. She is going to attend the execution tomorrow, and she will bring a picture of her brother. And who she describes in glowing terms, as one might expect. But she admits she doesn't know how she's going to feel afterwards, but still supports the execution going forward. You talk about anger and vengeance, and you can't fault a murder victim's family for feeling any way they feel, you know, anger, vengeance, right, whatever it is. If somebody were to hurt somebody in my sphere, family, friend, or whatever, I would be extraordinarily angry with them. My line is, jail does not protect, wouldn't protect us from you. Jail is protecting you from me. So I understand that visceral reaction. But as a society, we are not slaves to the visceral reaction of a victim's family, however justified or understandable as it is. And for the life of me, I don't understand the urge to execute people by calm, rational individuals who know that the individual who's being executed poses no threat to anybody else, who has changed their lives dramatically, who is contributing in prison, who will die in prison anyway, and they have to know intellectually it doesn't deter crime, because nobody who commits murder thinks they're going to get caught. That's not part of the process. There's not a weighing risk analysis. These are not, you know, actuaries who are saying, well, if I commit the murder, then I can do, you know, some time in prison.
Absolutely no impact on
the number of murders.
Right. On crime at all. And, you know, it's
and it's extraordinarily costly to society. It costs
millions of dollars paid by the government to defend these cases.
Well, to defend them, to
prosecute them. On both sides.
Right. And not to mention, and the costs don't take into account the courts and all the kind of ancillary costs of this kind of litigation that goes on and on and on. The Supreme Court is inundated with stay applications on death penalty cases. They happen weekly, sometimes more often than they actually denied two stays today. One was for Mr. Tysis and one was for another individual. So I don't get it, but I guess I don't have to entirely. I want to talk briefly about, and it touches on the death penalty as well, some of the treatment that our country has imposed upon inmates in Guantanamo Bay. There are still prisoners down there. And there's a UN working group on arbitrary detention who is highlighted a person by the name of Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, who was captured in 2002. They are recommending his release because of the torture that was imposed upon him during the course of his now 21 years of brutal incarceration in Guantanamo Bay.
Not for nothing. And this also reminds me, I don't have the episode keyed up, but we had this amazing lawyer who was played by Jodie Foster on our show in the movie The Mauritanian, about the innocent Guantanamo Bay detainee who was tortured into a false confession and ultimately released during a time when Obama was indicating he was going to close down Guantanamo Bay.
It's still not closed. It's been open.
30 prisoners in there, and but 17 of them Biden's seeking resettlement to other countries, but they have to go through some kind of checklist to ensure that the transfer will be a safe one and that they're being safely released into a country. But this report I was kind of surprised by, because I thought all the drama was over with Guantanamo Bay. But as you noted, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, he's accused of orchestrating the bombing of the U.S. Navy destroyer Cole off of Yemen 23 years ago. 17 sailors were killed. He hasn't gone to trial yet, but he is facing and awaiting a death penalty trial. But the problem is that while he's been awaiting trial and held before Guantanamo Bay, I believe in seven other nations at the direction of as part of the interrogation program enacted by George Bush, he has been waterboarded by psychologists contracted by the CIA. He's been confined naked in a wooden box. He's been threatened. He's been assaulted. He's undergone rectal abuse by agency staff members.
What the heck is that?
Well,
one can only imagine it. The phrase is horrifying.
It is. And it's funny, because sometimes as lawyers, you're writing memorandums and you're dealing with like really gory, sick, awful stuff, right? Whether you're dealing with a rape case or a brutal assault, and you have to choose your words carefully. I can only imagine what that means. And I'm sure the report is much more detailed. And I, you know, don't pretend that word is an attempt to sanitize the horrors he's undergone. But look, where someone's locked up, they either have due process or they don't. If they do, which they're supposed to, that means not torturing our inmates who don't pose a danger to anyone because they're locked up and confined to a cell.
Well, this report can be used in court, in that court, to help argue for his life if he's convicted. In October of 2021, a military jury in another Guantanamo Bay prisoner case urged clemency and called the prisoner's abuse a stain on the moral fiber of America. And they're talking about that individual's torture. So it is quite a problem down there. We have these individuals detained who have been tortured, and we don't know what to do with them. But the trials are proceeding, and the government's still trying to execute some of them, Mr. Nashari included. So we're about to end for this segment here. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk more New York law and some stop and frisk and actual innocence cases in what we call the trial penalty. We'll be right back after a few breaks.
Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette. Bruce, how do you eliminate an unconstitutional police policy that disproportionately targets people of color innocent of a crime?
You sue in federal court and get an order.
Or you just change the name of that policy.
Well, that works too, apparently, in New York City.
So stop and frisk was deemed unconstitutional in 2013 because, frankly, it was targeting disproportionately people of color. And a lot of those individuals, the vast majority of them, were actually innocent of crimes.
Well, let's stop for a second. I don't want to walk through this too quickly. Stop and frisk, we all recall it, right? It was very controversial. And to be candid, if you will, a number of my friends, I run in more conservative circles than I dare say you ordinarily do, or a lot of people do. My friends were perfectly happy with stop and frisk because they saw no problem with it. It's like a way to get guns off the street and so forth. And the statistics on the number of people stopped who were actually committing a crime is stunning. It was like 3%. That means you were throwing up 100 people against the wall to find three who were committing some kind of crime. So it was absolutely abhorrent. And of course, and I say of course because those who are even mildly familiar with the system should understand that, of course, most of the individuals were people of color, Hispanic, Black, or brown-skinned individuals. So I interrupted you.
No, I was going to say, little secret, I was running in very liberal circles back in the day when I worked at the Legal Aid Society in Brooklyn, and I won't disclose the name of this individual, but I remember speaking to an investigator who was former law enforcement, and I'd asked him, I said, why do you think gun violence is down? And he applauded stop and frisk as if it had saved the day. And I'm not sure the evidence corroborates that claim. And we'll talk about, in a bit, I want to tell you a little something I learned about, the media versus the facts. But Mayor Adams was intent on not duplicating the failures and the unconstitutionality of stop and frisk, but he created this neighborhood safety teams, is what he calls it. Basically, it's the anti-crime unit. No longer in total plain clothes. Their clothes are only slightly plain. They now have like the insignia of the, police, the police symbol, but they still appear relatively in plain clothes. And almost the same exact statistics have been unearthed by this monitor.
Well, you were talking about the statistics. First of all, 97% of the people stopped were Black or brown, overwhelming majority. Only 24% were found to be constitutional.
No, 24%,
24% were unconstitutional, correct.
But this is my favorite statistic.
Go ahead.
Out of 230 car stops, they found two weapons. And by the way, okay, two weapons. These are weapons that weren't reported in crimes. There was no 911 call linked to that weapon possession. And ultimately, in my view, no evidence, assuming that they found these two weapons based on a neighborhood safety team stop, as opposed to a stop and frisk stop. There was no evidence of any intent to use those weapons unlawfully. So it was almost pointless. And they learned of all this by reviewing police reports, watching body camera footage, and reviewing corresponding information with a team that included former police officers. So that's not good.
And the other interesting statistic, very interesting, is the crime rates in precincts where these units did not operate and where the officers were properly trained to work, I would say, normally without these anti-crime units. There's no difference in the crime rates, no difference in the homicide rates, no difference in the rates of violent crime. That if the police departments execute their job correctly and properly, they can do it without violating, you know, 97% of the individuals they stopped right not to be harassed and searched for no reason, and they can still prevent the violent crime. It's a difficult job we give to police, that we want them to enforce the law. We want them to not only arrest people who've committed crimes, but prevent crime to begin with. But smart policing, and we've had Pat Ryder on a couple of times, who is the commissioner of the Nassau County Police Department, and you hear him discuss how most of the violent crime is committed by a very small number of people, and the police department, at least in Nassau, tries to go about figuring out who those individuals are and targeting them by their conduct, by their history, by their criminal history, rather than just randomly stopping people on the street. So,
yeah, and look, I get like the some of the highest crime neighborhoods tend to be people that are living in indigent circumstances, and they're entitled to safety, like anybody else in any neighborhood. But at the same time, you're perpetuating this cycle where you're throwing people in jail, sometimes falsely. You're stopping them. You're creating a paper trail in their criminal history that ought not be there, that prevents them from getting jobs in the future. And you're not in that manner making for a better neighborhood ultimately in the future. And what's interesting is that Mayor Adams did this, I believe in response to, like, you know, allegations and somewhat conservative allegations that New York's run amok, it's out of control, crime rates are up, and they're astounding. And I actually sat down the other day to get some continuing legal education credits, and it was all about bail reform, right? Bail reform is seen by many lay people who aren't well-versed in criminal justice as the big culprit for all the crime being committed right now in New York. And what they found by comparing the law and the crime rates in 2019 to 2021, I appreciate that they didn't do 2020 because that was pandemic year. Everything was shut down. So the crime numbers weren't really representative of the functioning of criminal law and criminal policy, but rather a kind of social unusual event. So they compared 2019 to 2021 and found that the percentage of people released and rearrested in 2019 was 19%, but that in 2021, after bail reform, the percentage of people released and rearrested was 19.1%. So basically, no change whatsoever. And for violent felonies, there was a slightly greater discrepancy. In 2019, they found that the percentage of people released and rearrested for violent felonies was 3.1%, but that in 2021, that number rose to 3.6%. So not a single percentage point higher from 2019.
So half a percent.
Right. And what that money did for those individuals was, in many cases, supply like a year's worth of groceries for a family, you know, with children in a household, or medical care. Well,
the whole idea of bail reform, the criticism of bail reform, and I want to move on to some other things, but the idea is that the person is either in jail or they're not. That's not really the reality. What bail reform did is it hurt bail bond agencies who used to issue bail bonds for, $5,000 bails. It kept people in jail for $1,000, which no person should be sitting in jail waiting trial for $1,000. And it essentially said, you're going to be free, but you're not going to have to waste your money on bail, or you'll be free pending trial when you should be free pending trial. It's not as if they're letting murderers go or...
No, every single murder case that was remanded.
Right. I've represented a few people. I've represented a few over the years where the individual charged with homicide was free on bail, but the bails were astronomical, measured in $500,000 or millions of dollars in bond. And the purpose, of course, was to ensure their presence in court. In the cases that I'm thinking of, they did not commit any further crimes, and the individuals were ultimately exonerated, which means they shouldn't have been in jail for a day, let alone for the years it took while the case was pending. Moving from that, right, to what we can call the trial penalty or the trial tax, which is, I started the show off by saying that we're going to criticize the system tonight, which what's wrong with it. And the next place I want to go, and by the way, the 100th anniversary, there isn't a traditional wedding gift for a 100th anniversary. Not that we've been married for 100 episodes, but I suppose you could say that.
But we have been married.
the new gift for being married for 100 years, which I think it means you have to be 120 years old, right? I mean, you got to be a certain age to get married. You can't get married when you're born, is a 10-carat diamond. So there you go.
I wait that in my office mailbox tomorrow. Yeah,
you'll get it. The next place, the trial penalty, which means if you take a plea, you're going to get a plea bargain. But if you go to trial, exercise your constitutional right to go to trial, you're going to get hammered after the trial. Every courtroom in the country, you know that if you go to trial and lose, you're going to get substantially more time. Almost always, not always, but almost always, than you would have gotten had you simply taken a plea.
Let me dumb this down for a bit.
Go ahead.
Give you an example. A guy is charged with, a guy is stopped and frisked and he's got a gun and he's charged with possession of a loaded weapon, even though he didn't shoot it at anybody. It was in his pocket. Fine. And he meets up with a lawyer and he's told, if you go to trial and you lose, and the judge really, really, really likes you, you're going to get 3.5 years, or you can get up to 15 years in jail. But the prosecutor is offering you a plea to a reduced count and 1 year in jail, or say 5 years probation. And if you don't take that, that's fine. But if you go to trial and lose, you're going to get hammered. Right. You're probably not going to get the minimum. You could get 7 years, you could get 8 years, or depending on the judge, it might be 10. So that person, say that person is innocent. Say that person has a job, has a family, is thinking to themselves, okay, if I reject this deal, which gets me home sooner and gets me home with less pain and less risk, and I go to trial and lose, I may not come home for a decade. My kids will grow up without a father, my wife without a spouse, and who knows what'll happen to me in jail. So that person is incentivized to take a plea. And what people don't realize is that innocent people tend to be more risk adverse than guilty people. And this has been documented. And so it is not uncommon for innocent people to take guilty pleas to avoid the retribution of possible sentencing in the future should they be found guilty. And what the Innocence Project has found is that 25% of people that were exonerated, and this is out of 3,300 exonerees, 25% of those people who were later exonerated pled guilty to the crimes. And maybe they were exonerated with DNA evidence. I mean, talk about a false confession, you know, under oath, sworn to, and
with your lawyer standing next to you.
By your lawyers sitting next to you. And that more than 60% of those exonerations involve people of color. So it's crazy. I've had a judge once say to me, she was sitting next to me, she's like, well, obviously you wouldn't take a guilty plea if you knew your client was innocent. And I went, and it's not that I'm, suborning perjury. But I always say to myself, look, people tell me they're innocent and they're not, right? It's not common that people tell me they're guilty and they're innocent, but you never really know, right?
Most of the time you don't know, but the risk of, we talk about the trial penalty, the risk of going to trial and losing is staggering. And what it's done is it's reduced the number of trials down to almost nothing. Only 3% of the criminal cases in America today go to trial. 3%. The test of the system, the adversarial system, should be in a courtroom with discovery, with lawyers fighting on both sides, and you figure out what the right and wrong results should be. The conviction rate for prosecutors across the country at trial isn't 97% wins. It's high, but it's nowhere near that, which means that most of the cases that are coming in, only 3% are going to trial. Only 3%. That's not enough. It's not enough to keep the system honest, if you will.
It makes me wonder. I'm like, do we have those 3%? Because I feel like we're being sent to trial all the time.
Every week, all the time. Yeah, that's what judges look at us like, oh, God, right. They roll their eyes when we come in because we're frequently individuals that are at least willing to try cases. There was a case in Texas where Tyrone Day pled guilty to a rape, but with his lawyer mistakenly telling him he'd be eligible for parole after 4 years. He spent 26 years behind bars for a crime he did not commit. The Innocence Project and
Vanessa Potkin,
your friend and co-executive producer of The Last Defense on ABC, had him exonerated just a few weeks ago. And he got released after 26 years, and he pled guilty because he was afraid of the longer sentence, and he ended up with the longer sentence anyway.
And by the way, the fear is not just the clients. The fear is the lawyers as well, right? Because the client looks to you and you go, they're offering you this deal that is certain. It depends on the case, but you might say to your client, because this is what's been offered, like, look, they're offering you a lower level felony. They're offering you no jail. They're offering you probation. And if you want to go to trial, fine. I'm here for you. I'll fight to the death. But if you get convicted, you're facing upstate prison time, in a rape case, say sex registration, et cetera. And you're scared for that client and making the choice too, or at least I am, because that is a lot of pressure. You don't want to lose a case where the offer was no jail. Right.
Well, you don't want to lose a case at all, but certainly right. Where the offer is no jail. And look, plea bargaining and getting a break for taking responsibility is all fine and good. And it's a necessary part of the system. Right. People aren't going to plead guilty unless you offer them some incentive to. And if you offer them an incentive, it's only fair that the state or the prosecutor should receive something back, which is not putting the victims through a trial, spending the costs and resources of going to trial. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is an explicit theory or policy to punish people who go to trial. So if you go to trial and lose, not only are you going to get the sentence you would have gotten plus some, you're going to get punished for going to trial. And in Alabama, there is a lawmaker who is introducing literally what he's calling a trial tax. And it's not a tax for money. It is authorizing judges to sentence individuals outside higher than the guidelines if they opt for a trial, because they want people to be incentivized to take guilty pleas. And he was complaining, this lawmaker is complaining, that too many cases are going to trial in Alabama, where the number of cases going to trial in Alabama has plummeted to less than 1%. So nationwide, it's 3%. In Alabama, it's less than half the
number. Right.
Like
they've already got the trial tax bill without the bill.
Right.
So we're already terrified of going to trial.
One of the things that people should understand, at least in New York, is you can, if there's new evidence, you can make a claim of actual innocence if you went to trial. If you didn't go to trial and you pled guilty, even if there's proof, somebody else comes forward and confesses to the crime, and there's video evidence that that person actually committed the crime, there is no remedy for you in New York. You cannot bring a freestanding claim of actual innocence based upon what we call a 440 motion. You can only do it if there's DNA evidence and a court certifies that DNA testing will likely lead to a conclusion that you did not commit the crime. There's a special provision for DNA, but not for simply freestanding cases of actual innocence. So once you plead guilty, at least in New York, you really eliminate the ability or your right to challenge the conviction later on, despite overwhelming evidence of innocence.
Going to trial is scary. It really is.
It is. And it's something that
you make the decision before, in some cases, you know who the judge is to go to trial. You don't know where you'll be sent. You make the decision before you've met your jury. And you can never really know how the evidence is going to unfold. So I understand the dilemma.
No, it's something we deal with every day. I know it's something you're dealing with on a couple of cases right now. We have that going on all the time. We'll be back next week with more Crime and Justice Radio. Look forward to seeing you then or hearing from us. And feel free to visit our website at BarquetteEpstein.com. Click on the Crime and Justice Radio, and you can listen to the 99 episodes that preceded this. And I'm off to buy the 100th anniversary gift for my partner and co-host.
See you next week. Congratulations, Bruce. It's been a pleasure. Bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.